Hey there, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about episode 15 of our series on the conviction of Dennis Perry, On the Money Side of the Highway, which got into the festival of abuse that is civil asset forfeiture. And with us today is Susan Simpson. She's the host of Undisclosed. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group, but you already know that. She's also the host of the 45th podcast. You know that too. Welcome to the show, Susan. Tell us something we don't know about you.
I have never litigated civil asset forfeiture, but now I kind of want to.
Woohoo! Big fun. Also, you walk your cats like they're dogs, which is weird.
Singular. One is not going to put up with that nonsense.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay. wants nothing to do with that. Okay. Also with us today is Dan Albin. He was on the last episode. Dan Albin has served as an attorney with the Institute for Justice since September 2010. Dan litigates cutting-edge constitutional cases nationwide and has secured numerous court victories in federal and state courts for victims of civil forfeiture, property owners fighting eminent domain abuse, and entrepreneurs challenging occupational licensing. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you very much.
And so the Institute for Justice, that was built by Superman up at the North Pole, correct? Oh, no, that's the Fortress of Solitude. Sorry.
Yeah, we are often confused with that, but we do not wear capes here at IJ.
Got it. But now this is a private advocacy group?
Yeah, we're a public interest law firm. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we exist to defend constitutional rights when they're violated by the government at the federal, state, or local level.
Which civil asset forfeiture, does seem to come under that heading quite a bit. And property owners fighting eminent domain abuse, as well as entrepreneurs challenging occupational licensing, all of these are interesting issues that some would sort of equate politically with sort of a, I wouldn't say necessarily a libertarian outlook, but they are interesting because they cross all kinds of political lines. You know, civil asset forfeiture and criminal justice reform are something that I think that can be unifying issues for both Democrats and Republicans. It seems like a lot of people care about it. Would you say so?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we are explicitly a little L libertarian nonprofit, with a little L meaning not involved with the Libertarian Party in any way, but just philosophically libertarian. But we litigate in areas and do advocacy in areas that we think bring people together. There's wide support for civil forfeiture reform. One poll in December 2016 found that 84% of Americans are opposed to civil forfeiture. And you can't find 84% of Americans that agree on anything. So it's those kinds of issues that we tend to focus on and litigate where we think people's constitutional rights are being violated, and we think it's, you know, not necessarily a partisan issue, but one that people on the left, the right, and the center can all come together on.
So, Dan, throwback to season two here, but I know you went to Berry College in Rome. Are you aware of Floyd County ever engaging in asset forfeiture?
I'm sure it does, but I don't know of specific examples. But yes, I did go to Berry College, and while I was there, I did competitive public speaking on the intercollegiate circuit. And one of my topics my junior year was on civil forfeiture and how it's abused to, you know, take property away from people without charging them with a crime.
And well, you knew early another, on what you wanted to do.
Yeah. And another topic I spoke on was prosecutorial abuse. So your podcast really sort of brought both of those together in an interesting way for me.
But I have to say, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, I was completely unaware of civil asset forfeiture until maybe recently. There's actually a Republican blogger and Twitter personality who is going off about it. And I, as I said, I'm embarrassed to admit this, I was unaware of it. And I think when people become aware of it, they first, well, there's the five stages of death. It's like first they're surprised, then they're enraged. But, you know, we've gotten so many social media questions from people saying, how did this happen? I mean, how did they find this obscure law from the Admiralty and bring it up to a 1984 context?
Yeah, well, it's a sort of convoluted story, but the basic gist of it is that civil forfeiture was very rarely used in the early days of the country. It really existed to take away pirate ships or smuggler ships and their cargo, because the owner of the ship wasn't within the jurisdiction of the United States. And, you know, at the time, there was no way to go get that person in, you know, Britain or Spain or wherever they might be. It evolved somewhat during Prohibition in the early 20th century when some enterprising prosecutors sort of realized, hey, you know, smuggling, you know, tea or sugar is not all that different from smuggling rum or whiskey. And so we can use these civil forfeiture laws from long ago in admiralty law. We could maybe use those to go after folks that are, you know, bootlegging and trying to bring, you know, whiskey and rum into the country either by boat or by truck. And so it started to evolve a little bit where our civil forfeiture laws were starting to be applied to vehicles, auto vehicles coming across, you know, the Canadian border or the Mexican border. But it still, you know, didn't really explode, and obviously Prohibition ended. And so it wasn't until the 80s and the drug war, and specifically the 1984 Comprehensive Crime Control Act, that really empowered law enforcement to use civil forfeiture in a much broader way, and some similar reforms around that time that created a financial incentive for law enforcement to use civil forfeiture because it allowed them to keep the proceeds of anything they seized. And that really cracked the door wide open for abuse of forfeiture, because now not only were law enforcement officers empowered to go use civil forfeiture in a much broader way than they ever had before, but they had strong incentives to do so because their department would get up to 100% of the proceeds from what they seized. And so that really changed law enforcement priorities. And today you have a system where billions of dollars each year are being forfeited just at the federal level. It really dominates a lot of law enforcement priorities, unfortunately.
And they can seize anything, right? I mean, in this case, it's, you know, they've set up basically a machine to generate profits because they patrol, you know, almost exclusively the highway going south, which is the money highway, as we've called it. But I imagine that there's all manner of ways that they do this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are all sorts of methods that they follow to conduct these forfeitures. They're not all done on highways. Some are done at airports, for example. But pretty much any property can be seized. It has to be either the instrumentality of a crime, so somehow involved or connected with a crime, or the proceeds of a crime. And so, you know, that opens the door up to pretty much anything. And given that the standard is so low, you know, lots of people's property is vulnerable, even if it has, you know, really no connection to any illegal activity.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what I understand is they keep claiming that this is drug money they're using. But if charges aren't ever actually bought, how do they know that it's drug money?
Well, they just know. I mean, the position is, we know this is dirty money, or we know this is, you know, a car that comes from some sort of illicit drug trafficking. And yeah, we might not be able to prove that in a criminal court of law, but we know, you know, we have our sources, we have our investigative techniques, and they've indicated to us that this is the case. And I mean, that's what you'll hear time and time again from law enforcement is, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe we couldn't prove it in a you know, criminal proceedings, but we know these are bad guys.
You had cash and you're driving around with it. Of course you're a bad guy.
Right. I mean, that, frankly, that is, to most law enforcement, presumptively evidence of criminal activity. And, you know, depending on the amount of cash, of course, but that often is really all there is.
And one of the issues that we couldn't get to in the episode, but you told me about, was in Georgia, because it's a state-by-state kind of thing, but in Georgia, the reporting requirements there are definitely contributing to the issue of abuse.
Yeah, in Georgia, the there's very limited reporting, limited transparency about what's going on. Law enforcement agencies were not following what minimal reporting laws there were. Several years ago, we filed a lawsuit over this and you know, got an order that the agencies would have to comply. But the problem is the reporting requirements are very minimal, and the data is being reported in ways that makes it impossible to do comparisons even county to county. And so one of the important reforms that's needed in many states is these reporting requirement reforms. It's usually the first step towards broader forfeiture reform because it helps you know how big the problem is, what it actually is going on, whether the seizures and forfeitures are from people who are actually convicted of a crime or even charged with a crime. It's all that data that's sort of missing because of the absence of good reporting requirements.
Article is an online-only furniture company. By eliminating the layers of traditional retail, Article is able to keep prices low and quality high. They have no showrooms and no salespeople, just savings. Article offers beautifully designed modern furniture that's done with Scandinavian simplicity. And Article is serious about shipping. No matter how many items you order, every order is shipped at a flat rate of $49. And if you need some help getting set up, Article has options for in-room delivery and for assembly assistance. Finally, Article is quick and customer first. In-stock items can be expected in 2 weeks or less, and Article offers a 30-day return policy. Now, I can say I recently used Article to buy two Oscura console tables in bronze and walnut that I'm using as plant stands. The website was easy to use, the tables were delivered without a hitch, and the stands look great and are really well built. And now you can try Article too. Article is offering our listeners $50 off their first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/undisclosed. That's all it takes. Go to article.com/undisclosed and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/undisclosed to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
So are there jurisdictions where this kind of seizure goes on to the same degree that was going on in Camden, but because the sheriff there isn't always bragging about it, it goes under the radar?
I mean, there are lots of jurisdictions where this happens and happens pretty frequently. I mean, the entire state of Kansas, especially along the interstate, is one example. Same with Oklahoma. These are states that have, you know, long east-west interstates. Both of them adjoin Colorado, and so law enforcement often makes it a point to, you know, pull over people who are going to or from Colorado, pulls over folks with out-of-state plates or folks who maybe look like they don't belong in some way. And so you see, you know, quite a bit of forfeiture activity in those states, for example. And there are other, you know, cities and counties across the country where there seems to be kind of a hotbed of forfeiture. And we're still investigating those and digging into some of them.
So beside, you know, trying to make the process more transparent, has there been any effort to just flatly try to just overturn it, considering that, you know, it's one of the few things that people seem to be able to agree upon?
Yeah, there has been. And in fact, two states recently have eliminated civil forfeiture. New Mexico and Nebraska have essentially eliminated civil forfeiture altogether in their states. Now,
just state though, that, federally, can it still be done?
Well, so each of the states has a what we call an anti-circumvention provision that says forfeitures below a certain threshold, and it differs per state, but forfeitures below, say, $25,000 cannot be sent to the feds. And so for those forfeitures or for seizures of cash under $25,000, local and state law enforcement are not allowed to partner with the feds and do equitable sharing. But for amounts over that threshold, they are permitted to do it. So there will still be some federal civil forfeitures going on in those states, both just by the federal government itself. The fact that Nebraska and New Mexico have gotten rid of it under state law doesn't mean that, for instance, DEA or Customs and Border Protection can't continue doing federal seizures in those states. And those same agencies will likely partner with state and local agencies when there are seizures that exceed the anti-circumvention threshold in each state.
But there hasn't been any kind of federal effort to get rid of it. Or has there been constitutional challenges?
There are ongoing efforts to get rid of it federally, both legislatively. So on the litigation side, it's more of an incremental game. You rarely can just bring a case that challenges all of civil forfeiture. But this term, and in fact later this month, we have a case before the Supreme Court challenging a civil forfeiture on excessive fines grounds. The Eighth Amendment provides that you can't impose excessive fines, and we're representing a gentleman who was convicted of selling something like $260 worth of heroin, and he was sentenced to a year in prison, something like $1,300 in fines, 5 years probation. After he was convicted and not part of the criminal proceeding, a private law firm acting on behalf of the state, basically on a contingency fee basis, tried to forfeit his Land Rover through civil forfeiture, saying, hey, he was arrested in this Land Rover, and therefore it was an instrumentality of the crime. He was using it to drive around, and he sold the heroin to the police sting operation while he was in this Land Rover. And the Land Rover is worth, you know, something like $40,000. That appears to be a pretty excessive fine compared to what he was actually criminally sentenced to. And so we're challenging that in the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of this month.
Yeah, but it seems like I think the objection that most people have to it is the vast incentivizing of corruption. In my mind, that's a tougher case to make in terms of, because he was in the vehicle when he committed the crime. You know, there's a logical, you're right, it's excessive, but there is a, you know, it was involved in the commission of the crime. It seems like what most people object to is just it poisons the system.
But how far can it go too? Like, if theoretically speeding is involved in a crime, so...
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, not all crimes are crimes that are eligible for forfeiture. And so, yeah, typically it's going to be drug crimes, crimes involving smuggling, money laundering, a wide variety of financial type crimes. But those are the primary ones for which forfeiture is an eligible thing that can be pursued. I think certainly the profit incentive that is created is one of the central problems of civil forfeiture. And there are cases percolating up in the lower courts. We won, for instance, in Albuquerque, a challenge to their ongoing civil forfeiture system, which existed sort of despite state law. Even though state law had changed, Albuquerque was still proceeding on the theory that they could, under their own municipal laws, pursue civil forfeiture. And we were able to demonstrate that a substantial percentage of that went to pay, law enforcement salaries and other benefits. And the court found that, in fact, it did. So, and we're bringing other challenges in a number of other jurisdictions challenging this profit incentive and how it tends to create, severe violations of due process where somebody, is having their property taken by prosecutors and law enforcement officers who have every incentive to take their property, because at the end of the day, the proceeds go back to their offices and sometimes even into their own pockets through salary, overtime, and other benefits.
So we heard about some of the expenditures from Camden County, but outside of Camden, what are some of the more extravagant expenditures you've seen?
Well, I mean, there's a whole laundry list of them. There was... money used to buy a margarita machine in Texas. There's been money spent on trips to places like Aspen or Hawaii for law enforcement or prosecutor conferences.
Vegas. Andy County went to Vegas on their drug money.
Yeah, it's you name it. There are obviously conferences in very desirable places, and forfeiture money is frequently spent for things like that. In Oklahoma, it was being used to pay for a prosecutor's student loans, and in another example, to pay for a home that a prosecutor was living in for several years. It's been also used for things like hiring a clown to attend some sort of community outreach event. So you get all sorts of bizarre expenditures. In Ohio, I think it was Puddles the Clown was the name of the clown. I forget the name. It was a very funny name of a clown, but yeah,
I'm sure.
it was Sparkles the Clown. That was
Sparkles,
the name.
Sparkles
the Clown was one of the expenditures. And
Sparkles is worth every penny. I'm sorry. If you've ever seen Sparkles, he does just magnificent work.
Yeah, I'm sure. And there's also kind of the classic sort of sports cars and other things that we talked about a bit on the episode. That's a pretty common thing, and they'll say, oh, well, we need it as a pursuit car, or we need it for undercover operations, or we need it for community outreach events. Those are common.
I'm sorry, I had to ask about that. The DARE car. First of all, I'm new to the concept of DARE cars, and the fact that they were the number one DARE car is great and all. What does that mean? Why does one have a DARE car? Certainly, why do you need a Dodge Viper? And actually, Andrew, my assistant, had a perfect question for that. He said, are you really sending the right message to the children of your DARE program when you tell them, look what we bought with drug money? obviously, it's not up to you to answer this question, but can somebody answer the question as to why do they have DARE cars?
I mean, I think...
I'm sure you can use an excuse, I guess.
Yeah, it's because it's a cool excuse to buy toys. I mean, the official reason is, well, we want to appeal to children. We want to, do something that's going to get kids' attention at community outreach events, and a cool sports car is going to do that. And that, you know, there may be some truth to that, but I think the real reason is we'd like to drive a sports car, and the justification we can come up with is if we use it, you know, once a year or a few times a year at these DARE events, then the rest of the year we can, you know, drive the car in our commute or, you know, on patrol or whatever. And boy, isn't it fun to drive a Dodge Viper.
And in Camden County, one of the issues is that a lot of the law enforcement, like both the officers and just like, you know, support staff would have county-owned cars. They wouldn't be Vipers. They, you know, a little bit toned down from that. But they had cars that they could use for their own use, essentially. They would drive them home at night. And something like 2/3 of the fuel costs for the sheriff's office came not from, like, patrol cars, but from these take-home cars that were largely bought with drug money.
It seems like that everybody's using the rationalization that, look, this is money from ill-gotten gains. Isn't it good that we're using it for charitable donations, say? You know, it's hard to argue with them, you know, giving to the Boy Scouts, giving to the cheerleaders, giving to, you know, all those things are undeniable goods. So is that the rationalization?
So I will note that, like, on the message boards, when some of the stuff came out, it was interesting to see how the community reacted, because there were people on, like, the pro Sheriff Smith blogs who were suddenly looking at these numbers and going, wait, what? And, like, one person who was commenting was a member of the search and rescue team that apparently had struggled to get funding. A lot of private citizens using their own money, like, you know, divers, searchers, people, you know, volunteering their time to do search and rescue. And they were getting like $200 from the sheriff's office. So they'd see these numbers come out from the bank accounts. And they're like, wait, what? The Boy Scouts are getting $20,000? The playground's getting $10,000? And we're spending our own money for search and rescue? So it does, once it's known publicly, like who's getting paid and who's not, there is some sort of conflict caused there as well. But at the same time, for the most part, all anyone sees is, hey, Sheriff Bill Smith is getting our county a new insert blank here.
Yeah, I think a lot of those expenditures are pretty sort of self-aggrandizing expenditures that are designed to, you know, promote the sheriff or whomever it is that's sort of bestowing these grants on the various, you know, local charities. But I think it highlights a sort of deeper problem, which is the separation of powers problem at issue here. We are not supposed to have the power of the sword united with the power of the purse. The legislature is supposed to be the branch of government that is supposed to make spending decisions like this. And if the legislature thinks a wise use of tax dollars is to donate, you know, $20,000 to the Boy Scouts, that's fine. They're politically accountable for that. And it's a decision being made in the context of, you know, the overall budget for, say, the county. But if an executive branch agency is making these spending decisions and is just sort of doling out money that's never really goes through any kind of budgetary controls, because it's this off-budget slush fund that the sheriff gets with the forfeiture funds, then you have this real problem where the executive is both deciding to take the money and is deciding how that money is spent, and the legislature, which in this case I guess would be like the county board, never really has any say in it. And that's not how things are supposed to work under our system of government. We're not supposed to unite the power of the purse and the power of the sword, because that can create really bad incentives, e.g. the Sheriff of Nottingham. And, you know, you would think that that would be something that would be of greater concern.
Well, the Board of Commissioners in Camden County agreed with you. This was a long-running dispute. For a while, essentially, Sheriff Smith was just the only person signing off on these checks, and they were arguing they should have, you know, co-signing authority on this. And there was some pushback eventually, but for about 7-8 years there, it was basically an open slush fund that the sheriff controlled completely.
Is the sheriff still in office?
Oh, no, no. Sheriff Smith? Oh, no. Yeah, it goes back to the political issues here in this case, in that the son of Agent Joe Gregory, who investigated this case originally and firmly believes Ms. Perry is innocent, he's the one who ran against and defeated Bill Smith and ended his 3 generations in office.
Ah, okay. So there was more to find out in this area. Okay. You know who fascinated me was Rick Rogers. Have you made any attempt to actually communicate with him?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's not worked out so great. I've talked to him. I've emailed with him. I've had interviews scheduled. Last minute, something always comes up.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. He sounds like
quite a character.
Yes, that's the impression I get.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, hey, Rick, you know, we're nice people. We'd love to talk to you. Love to have you as an addendum guest. I'm just saying. Putting that out there, Rick. Come on. That's fame. You know, I found myself as a listener just incredibly grateful that this guy was such a pain in the ass.
Not many in Camden County feel that way.
Oh, really? Okay.
I particularly am very grateful to him.
Yes, he's a gadfly. You got to be grateful for the gadflies sometimes. Okay, I had a couple of questions about the Rogers, actually, from the episode. Did they initially deny that they got the reward money completely?
Yes, their position is that they did not get the money. Frankly, I think that from people, I've heard others say what Deputy Butch Kennedy said about Glenda Rozier, the mother, acknowledging that they got the reward. So my suspicion is very much that she knew. I do not know if the rest of the family knew.
Did they know about the scholarship was to the daughter?
Yes. So the one thing they did in Camden County is it's not just like scholarships and textbooks for actual officers, which is pretty common. Dan was telling me that seems like a pretty sort of a recurring thing that happens with these sort of seized asset funds. But in Camden County, it's not only going to pay for tuition and books for, you know, deputies on the force, it's going to pay for their family members too. For instance, Dale Bundy's daughter got her textbooks and tuition paid. Now, in this case, the Rozier's daughters were both in law enforcement. So I don't know the exact timing. If they were working for Camden County or even for the sheriff's office at the time they got these items paid for, but it's possible. Both of them have worked at various jurisdictions. And I believe in 03 or 04, I don't believe Vicky was there, but Laurie may have been.
Yeah, this is so strange because, again, as you've pointed out, the leads provided were useless. The man never testified. What on earth could this guy have done? Is he connected to other cases for the sheriff?
You know, that's what, when I talked to Bill Smith, that's what he seemed to be genuinely, like, not recall, who knows, but he did not recall, told me he didn't recall what this was for. And he was like, wait, Corky Rozier's involved in that case? Are you sure it wasn't for a different case? Which to me implied that he knew of other cases. This might make sense. He was just surprised to hear it brought up in the context of the Swain case. I don't know that for a fact. There is a long friendship there between the Rozier's and, you know, the sheriff. So maybe it could have been something simple as, like, the sheriff figures, why give all the money to Jane Beaver? I'll split it and give it my buddy Corky. I don't know. I wish I had more answers there. I just don't have them. Especially since it's clear that the Rozier story, I don't even know why they wanted to call him at trial. Then the case was so thin, the prosecutor was desperate. He was trying to use everything he had. And then halfway through trial, it's like, wait, I can't call Corky and Glenda Rozier. This would ruin the case. I don't know. That is still a mystery. It does not make sense.
And I wanted to get to the drug court. How could Amanda Williams, the judge there, be expected to have any kind of impartiality if her drug court depends on donations from people prosecuting Dennis Perry? That's textbook.
I don't have any answers for you.
Well, first of all, okay, what is a drug court in this context? Because there's a wonderful Netflix documentary called Heroin about people dealing with drugs in a small town in America. And it involves a lot of footage of a functioning drug court, which in that particular iteration is a court explicitly to prosecute drug crimes, but with a much more sort of humanistic attitude of trying to get these people out of the lifestyle of drug abuse. And it was a fascinating documentary. Is that what Amanda Williams was doing?
That was the theory of what this drug court was going to be. Yes, exactly that. It was a drug court set up to handle sort of drug-related crimes with the idea that we can use our justice system in a different way here and get better outcomes, as we'll discuss in later episodes. in practice, that may not have been what happened.
But why would that need funding from asset forfeitures? I'm sorry. I mean, it just seems like you either have a drug court or you don't. I don't know why you would need funding from this other source.
Well, the drug courts are based on sort of a more intensive like oversight of the people involved. You need more resources to keep track of what they're doing, have check-ins, drug testing. I don't know the full expenses there were, but it would have more expenses than the ordinary court. And at least in Glynn County, where this was being done, the solution was to have separate funding paid from various agencies in the Brunswick Circuit. So in Georgia, you have each county has its own sort of system set up. But for smaller counties, you'll have them come together in circuits. So in here, we have a few counties. Brunswick is the sort of seat, but that's Glynn County. And then we have Camden County and a few others in that area are all called the Brunswick Circuit. So they all use the same sort of court sometimes or same DA. So there was funding coming from a few sources around the Brunswick area. But a lot of that was coming from Sheriff Smith and his seized assets fund.
And we also, obviously, he was using that money to fund private, well, not private investigators, but bringing in new investigators for older cold cases.
At least in this case. I wish I knew exactly what happened with how they hired Bundy and how his payment was, I don't know. All I know is what Bill Smith has described. And based on his descriptions, it is possible that they did not technically violate anything by initially hiring or rehiring Bundy with the Seized Assets Fund. I don't know, Dan, if you have more thoughts there.
Not necessarily. I don't know as much about it. But, I mean, hiring someone to conduct an additional investigation doesn't strike me as something that would necessarily be outside the scope of what would be permitted for the use of forfeiture funds.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly sounds more relevant to what the money's supposed to be spent on than margarita machines and Sparkles the Clown.
Yeah. Typically, it's limited to like a 1 year period, which the Sheriff Smith says what happened. So who knows? What the issue for me is, if that's really what happened here, why is Bundy denying it and telling a story about a grant that I could never prove existed?
Can we FOIA for the...
No. Wait, what are you going to say?
Well, no, I was about to say for Jan Arino, because he claimed he got, I know a guy. I know a guy who's really good at the FOIAs.
I thought you were going to say the local records, and those are all gone. They don't have any more. But I did not... Yeah, no. So, Dan, any thoughts on how you can find out what Jan Arino had to say about this?
I mean, theoretically, yes. It's been such a long time. Who knows what's still going to be around from back then. But, I mean, they are supposed to preserve those sorts of records. I don't know in what manner Janet Reno gave the thumbs up to this. It may be sort of reading between the lines of a memo or something, but at least theoretically could be out there.
Okay. I'll call my guy. I'm on it. First, I'm looking for obscure television shows. Now I'm
Janet Reno's correspondence with Sheriff Smith.
Yes.
A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can create a beautiful website to turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, promote your physical or online business, or announce an upcoming event or special project. Let's say you want to create a website about the use of arsenic in Turkey medication, or a website about all the cases in which prosecutors have forced defendants to waive away the right to appeal, or a website about all the true crime cases covered on Unsolved Mysteries. Squarespace has got you covered. They offer beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel as well as settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, everything optimized for mobile right out of the box, a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, analytics that help you grow in real time, built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. So head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
We've got some social media questions. A lot of them are just, you know, people just being as surprised as I was that this existed. But here we have from Catherine Squillens, who says, I have long been outraged at the civil forfeiture laws and practices. I simply do not understand how this law is constitutional. And that's why I was asking about if there's been constitutional challenges.
I mean, there have been constitutional challenges to various aspects of civil forfeiture over the years. Unfortunately, it does have some historical roots, so it's not something that the court is going to be likely to toss out completely, because it is something that at least, you know, the founders, when they wrote the Constitution, they were probably aware existed. But a pretty famous challenge was about 20 years ago in 1996, the Bennis v. Michigan case involving a woman whose husband used her car to pick up a prostitute. He was arrested with the prostitute in the vehicle. The police charged him with solicitation and attempted to forfeit her car, the wife's car. She obviously didn't consent to this and challenged it and argued that under the federal constitution, she had a right to bring an innocent owner defense to say, look, I wasn't there. I wasn't the one who used the property to commit the crime. And since I wasn't there, I should have my property returned to me. And bizarrely, the U.S. Supreme Court actually ruled, nope, sorry, the police can take your car. There is no federal due process right to be able to make this this innocent owner defense. And it's sort of been this pretty notorious opinion on civil forfeiture, saying, you know, kind of giving it a thumbs up, some approval from the Supreme Court. But it's been viewed since that time as in a pretty negative light. And, you know, I think the court lately has been walking back any endorsements of civil forfeiture because they've realized how far civil forfeiture has come from what it looked like back in the days of the founding. And they think it's really come unmoored from its original sort of constitutional uses.
So, Dan, I have a question for you. In some of the expenditures I've noticed from Camden County, it seems like about every month they're taking a big chunk of money, setting aside and splitting it 90-10 between the Board of Commissioners and the DA's office. Any guesses what that's about or what that's for?
They're splitting forfeiture money 90-10?
Not, they take a chunk out and that amount, 90% goes to the board, 10% goes to the DA's office.
Huh. No, I haven't seen a split like that. I mean, they may be in some way trying to. Honestly, I'm not really sure what that would be. You know, the equitable sharing split is normally 80-20, with 80% going to the local government and 20% being kept for the feds.
Well, let's just poke. It's all going to Camden County Sheriff's Office, and then they are taking from their pool of money, distributing it.
So, it may be that they've reached an arrangement whereby, you know, the Board of Commissioners wants the bulk of the money, but is willing to let, you know, the DA's office keep 10% for walking around money, and that's kind of the default deal they've reached. I don't really know.
It's clown money, really.
Yeah.
We've got another question. Well, it's not really a question. It's more of a statement from Lana Liberty, who says, so basically, the Camden County cops are drug dealers. Assuming money confiscated is truly drug money, rather than stop the northbound cars and confiscating the actual drugs, so they are now never sold and arresting the perpetrators, they choose to confiscate the money coming south. So it basically makes them complicit in the crime.
Yeah, I don't know that I go so far as saying they are drug dealers, but they're certainly profiting from drug trafficking. Those are two different things, but you could see how one's priorities could really get skewed given those incentives, and in fact seem to have become skewed in Camden County. You know, there isn't a financial reward for stopping the drugs as they're headed north, because, you know, assuming you're honest, you basically just have to destroy the drugs. There is a very strong financial reward for seizing the cash as it's headed south. And so that's one of our biggest criticisms of civil forfeiture and the incentives that are set up. You don't have to be a crooked cop to be influenced by this. Anyone would be influenced by these incentives. And so our concern is this is distorting law enforcement priorities. They're spending a lot of time trying to pull over people with cash and less time on actually stopping crime. And even if you're a law and order conservative, that should be troubling. You should want your law enforcement to be spending their time on actual crime and not on revenue raising.
And one thing Sheriff Smith told me that I found fascinating was his sort of casual way of saying, oh, yeah, that money came from a South American drug cartel. I'm like, well, one, how do you know that if you're not prosecuting these cases? I mean, how would you possibly know which cartel it's going to? And two, like, that basically means that jurisdictions like this, there's incentive to not destroy a cartel that's giving you
exactly.
a lot of drug seizure money.
Yeah, it's part of their lifeblood.
Like, you don't want to kill the golden goose. Like, the cartel needs to keep, like, you want to probably undermine it and, like, take a big chunk of its money away, but you don't actually want that cartel to stop existing.
Yeah, it disincentivizes the whole point of the drug war, which was ostensibly to cut down on people actually using drugs. That was the theory way back when we started it.
And now the point is to get Dodge
Vipers.
Everybody
was all full of hope. Yes, now is to get the cool Dodge Vipers. We got many comments from people, like one from Ellen Essens, who says, yes, I have questions after listening to the latest episode. What? 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 What just happened? Sorry, I'm clearly not ready to articulate my questions yet. I am absolutely stunned and horrified. We got another one. My jaw is on the floor.
People should be.
People should be. Absolutely. Absolutely. Another one who says, what did I just listen to? If I didn't know that you superheroes, undisclosed team, were out there, I would be even more horrified than I am right now. So, you know, obviously it struck a nerve with people.
Well, I'd be even more horrified if I didn't know that people like the IJ firms out there are actually litigating it. Because this is stuff like you can't really, obviously legislation may be a good fix, but obviously that's not working. But there are constitutional issues here that need to be addressed. And to do that in an effective way, you need not just sort of piecemeal random litigation from random litigants all over the U.S. You need someone who's taking cases with an eye to develop legal precedent, which is far more effective than any kind of just like haphazard clients get whatever attorneys they can kind of approach. So to have a nonprofit that's dedicated to taking the cases that need representation and can be brought with sort of a bigger picture in mind of where it's going to go, I think that makes all the difference. So I'm glad y'all are working on that, Dan.
Well, thanks very much. And yeah, I mean, that is sort of our unifying mission is to impact litigation where we set precedent that doesn't just help our clients, but helps people around the country or at least in the state where the case is being brought. And, you know, we do have a strategic vision of the areas that we think are particularly susceptible to legal challenge, areas of civil forfeiture that are more unconstitutional than others or at least more likely to find judges that will strike them down. And so, you know, part of what we do is look for cases that present those issues and then try to litigate them in courts that we think might get us a decision that would have a broader impact and not just be something that affects our clients. I'll say one difficulty with that is, you know, we often find excellent clients, very sympathetic, who have really strong legal arguments. And what happens almost as soon as we file our case is the government just decides to return whatever the property was that was seized, and that effectively moots the case. And so we've had a half dozen or so cases that have ended within a week or two, sometimes even the same day that we've brought the case. And, you know, it's hard to say necessarily that it's a concerted effort by law enforcement to moot these cases, but certainly each individual law enforcement agency is making a decision that, look, we'd rather just return this money and not have a ruling on the books from a court shutting down our whole system. And so, you know, we'll give up whatever it was that was seized in this case and live to fight another day and, you know, continue on with our forfeiture scheme. And so that's something that, you know, makes it difficult sometimes to establish the precedent that we want to set.
Yeah, they just throw it back if ever y'all get involved.
Is the hope that you championing these laws of transparency, is the hope that the transparency will create the political will to change it?
Yeah, I think the idea is the transparency reforms will enable folks who want to advocate for other further legislative reforms, will enable them to point to the actual data and say, look, this is what's happening. This is the magnitude of the problem. Because frequently forfeiture defenders, usually in law enforcement, will just say, look, there's no problem here. There's no evidence there's any problem in this state, and just kind of try to, you know, brush it over and say, look, there's nothing going on here, nothing to see. You're thinking about something that's happening in other states, but not here. And when you actually have the data and can say, well, actually, you know, there's you know, this many millions of dollars coming in each year, and there were this many seizures, and, you know, each one of them had an average of, you know, $1,000 or whatever it was, you can really establish kind of how big the issue is, how much abuse there is, that kind of thing. And hopefully, create, you know, the more substantive reforms, like requiring a criminal conviction before any forfeiture can take place, or more importantly, making sure that any funds seized are directed to a general fund that's controlled by the legislature and not to law enforcement slush funds.
Well, that would help quite a bit. We also got a lot of suggestions. You know, our last episode presented a bit of a mystery. We're still searching for a particular episode of Prime Suspect. And Joshua Tice says, I'm pretty sure that Prime Suspect's episode might be found on the website retrojunk.com. Just have to have the time to search for it. Well, thank you, Josh. Yet another thing that we're going to be looking into. We really do appreciate these ideas. We also got an idea to look at the Paley Center, which is a museum of broadcasting. I've searched them just yesterday, and unfortunately, they don't have it. They have plenty of the Prime Suspects with Helen Mirren. They have plenty of the Prime Suspects.
You're constant, though. Stop storing Helen Mirren once and start storing these people.
Yeah, yes, exactly. We also got one from Kimberly Cooper, who says, hi, I was just listening to the latest episode of Undisclosed. I live in Columbia, Missouri, and I didn't know what kind of digging or footwork could be done on my end to see if the tapes could be found. Who have you been speaking to at MU and could I see about following up? Thanks, Kimberly says. No, we say to you, Kimberly, thank you. It is very kind of you to offer to help. Susan, I don't know if you're looking to follow up with people who are on the ground there.
Not gotten solid answers on from them yet, if there's even a place we can search, but if they would be willing to have someone come in and do the legwork themselves, I'm going to take up on that.
Yes. And actually, if somebody wants to spend the time looking through retrojunk.com, which, by the way, sounds awesome. I have a feeling there's a fair amount of me on retrojunk.com. So it might make sense for me to take some time and look at that. But if any of our listeners want to take a swing at that. Also, we got something from Jerry Stumpf, who says, hey, I just had an idea listening to you guys to track down the tape of Prime Suspect. Since copies were given to police departments featured in their stories, and since the host didn't know if they were copies or full episodes or just the segments, and also because it would be potentially more difficult to send individual segments rather than whole episodes, it would be worthwhile investigating what other cases were featured in that same episode to see if you can approach one of the other departments featured in that same episode.
We are working on it. So
yes.
Far, no luck. Because,
yes.
of course, the one that we think we're pretty sure we identified, that case involved a massive loss of evidence as well.
Great. Yet another argument for better evidence retention policies. That is something we come up against all the time here, Dan. I'm a broken record about that. I think we have one last one from J.L. Whitaker, who asks, is there any evidence of the reward elsewhere? Or is it just the Prime Suspect episode? Newspapers, etc., local radio, maybe?
There was another reward. It was established right after the murders, within a couple weeks. I can't find any evidence that it grew beyond maybe a few thousand. And the reward said it was being held at the local bank. And if it was not ever paid out, it'd be donated to the local library and other places. As far as I can tell, as far as the library in question can tell, that money was never donated to it. So we don't know what happened to that reward. At the same time, it would not have been anywhere near the $25,000 that this one was.
Well, that's it for our social media questions. I wanted to thank you, Dan, for coming. You've told us a lot of very eye-opening information. Although I didn't get to the entrepreneurs looking to change licensing procedures. We didn't get to that. That'll have to be its own addendum at some point.
It'll come to the case eventually, and then we'll call on you, Dan.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, sure. Well, we represent folks like African Hair Braiders who are challenging cosmetology licensing regulations. So if you ever want to talk about that, I'm happy to do so.
Actually, I have railed about that. not necessarily about that in particular, but just that our cosmetology licensing is very, very difficult considering how easy it is to become a police officer. Licensing, I've compared and contrasted the two to great effect on this show. But thanks again, Dan.
Yeah, thank
you. Sure, thank you.
And Susan, it's always lovely to talk to you, and I'm very much looking forward to our next episode.
All right, and we'll keep looking for that VHS tape.
Yes, wish us luck. There you go. That is the addendum for this week. And I'm going to remind everybody, Undisclosed now has a Patreon. It is patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And you get bonus episodes with Susan, Rabia, and Colin. And we are so, so grateful for any help you can give. Also, if you have any information regarding Dennis Perry's case, call us at 410-205-5000. 5563 or email us at undisclosedpod@gmail.com. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice related charities that you can make a donation to there. As I've said, I am donating all of my fees this season to the Georgia Innocence Project once again. You can find them at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle @UndisclosedPod and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew. Every week he comes up with funny stuff. I love him. Thank you for the research. As well as Hannah McCarthy, who's doing our audio production, and Patrick Cortez, who composed the addenda theme. Thank you, guys, and thank you to Methil Telhan, our project manager, who makes this fun every week, and I'm very much looking forward to the next time I will be back in your home, or car, or boat, or RV.